obedience is an imperative. We're going to be looking at Joseph's obedience this morning. And as we talk about children, how that relates to children, say, why is it so important? Why is the one command that is issued to children in Scripture is honor your father and mother, and Paul repeats it in the New Testament. I'm drawing a blank on where that's at. Colossians and Ephesians, children, obey your parents. Because how children learn to obey their parents is how they will obey God when they grow to adulthood. So moms and dads, why is it so imperative, and grandparents, that we are teaching our children to obey and to respect the authority of parents is because that is they will translate that into their respect for the authority of God over their lives. And we're going to look at that example in Joseph here in just a little bit. But I want to take just a little bit of a tangent this morning because Matthew, as we get into Matthew chapter 2, or as we have been in it, Matthew quotes Old Testament prophecy more than any of the other gospel writers because his purposes are different. As we talked about when we were introducing the gospel, each gospel writer has his own point that he wants to make. Okay, John is specifically writing with the purpose of convincing people that Jesus is the Son of God, the Savior of the world. That's his singular purpose. So the material that he puts into his gospel is reflective of that. That's the point he wants to make. Luke's gospel is to show us that Jesus is the perfect Son of Man. And so the accounts that he puts into his gospel all work toward that point. Matthew's point, Matthew's purpose in writing is to show us that Jesus is the Messiah. That's a very Jewish perspective. We don't use the term Messiah a whole lot. Well, we do in our Christian circles and churches, and especially churches that are dispensational and very supportive of Israel as God's chosen people, because we recognize that that term is a very Jewish term, Messiah. The Western term for Messiah is Christ, and everybody knows the term Jesus Christ, but that's a translation of the word Jesus the Messiah. What is the Messiah? That is God's anointed, chosen king. It specifically relates to the fulfillment of the promises to David and to Abraham. Christ is the chosen one. He's the anointed one. And Matthew's point in telling the story of Jesus, and not story as in fable, fairy tale story, but relating the accounts of Jesus' life, is to convince us that Jesus is the Messiah. Remember, Matthew is writing to a primarily Jewish audience. He is writing to convince the people of Israel that Jesus is their Messiah. And he's writing to convince us that as well. So, Matthew quotes more Old Testament prophecy than any of the other gospel writers. In Matthew 1:23, when we're talking about the birth of Christ, Matthew quotes Isaiah 7:14, "Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and you shall call his name Emmanuel." Why does he quote that passage? Because Jesus fulfilled it. He was born of a virgin. Completely literal way. We're not trying to explain away that term virgin at all. It is miraculous. It doesn't normally happen. It's happened once in the history of the world. It will never happen again that a woman will be able to bear a child without the normal process. God did it one time. He did it in a miraculous way, and that was in the person of Jesus. He did that so that all eyes could be focused on Christ, so that that miraculous event would draw our attention to the person that was born that way. It's something spectacular. It's something out of the ordinary. It's something very, very unusual. And it was predicted long before it happened. Isaiah writes to us somewhere in the middle of the 8th century BC, about 750 years before Jesus was born. And he gives us this prophecy, "Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and you shall call his name Emmanuel." And Matthew tells us that Emmanuel in Greek means, or in English, means God is with us. Jesus is the fulfillment of that prophecy. God became a man and lived with us. He also, in chapter 2, verse 6, as we looked at last week, and this was a fantastic from just a literary point of view, because Matthew doesn't interject this prophecy into the account. It's actually the people in the account that tell us. It's the scribes and the high priests in Jerusalem when they're asked, where's the Messiah going to be born? They're the ones that give us this prophecy. And it's from Micah chapter 5, verse 2. But you, Bethlehem, Ephrathah, who are too little to be among the clans of Judah, from you shall come forth for me one who is to be ruler in Israel. That prophecy fulfilled in the person of Jesus Christ, who was born in Bethlehem. Matthew leaves off a small part of the last of this, which is important to pointing towards the person of Christ, but his purposes are different. Matthew omits the last phrase of that prophecy in Micah. It says, whose coming forth is from of old, from ancient days. Who is this king? It's God himself coming down to rule his people. God become man. And again, Matthew's purpose is not necessarily to convince everybody that Jesus is God, though that's part of it. But he's focusing more on the messiahship of Christ. And so when he quotes this prophecy, he's specifically pointing out the Messiah is going to be born in Bethlehem. Jesus was born in Bethlehem to fulfill this prophecy. In chapter 2, verse 15, we're going to look at here this morning as we read in our scripture reading. He quotes from Hosea 11:1, out of Egypt I called my son. God prophesied many years before Jesus went to Egypt that he would call his son out of Egypt. So why did Jesus go to Egypt? So that he could fulfill prophecy. So that all these things could point to the person of Christ. Who is Jesus? He's the Messiah, the fulfiller of prophecy. In Matthew chapter 2, verse 18, he's going to quote from Jeremiah 31:15. A voice is heard in Ramah, lamentation and bitter weeping. Rachel is weeping for her children. She refuses to be comforted because they are no more. Again, this prophecy relating to the events surrounding Christ and his birth. And the destruction of the children in Bethlehem was prophesied many years before it happened. Why does Matthew spend so much time telling us that Jesus fulfills prophecy? Because in Isaiah chapter 46, verse 10, God is challenging his people who are swallowed up with their idolatry. They're absolutely engrossed in the worship of foreign gods, of Baal, of Marduk, of Chemosh, the gods of the nations that were around Israel at the time. And Israel had almost completely succumbed to worshiping these foreign gods. And so in challenging them in this regard, Isaiah writes this prophecy, God speaking through Isaiah, and he's basically says, to whom will you compare me? Can any of the other gods do this? And here's what he's going to say, declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times things which have not been, saying, my purpose will be established, and I will accomplish all my good pleasure. What other god can tell you the end of things before they've started? What other god can tell you how the story is going to end when it's only just begun? What other god can predict events a little far into the future? No other god can. So why does Matthew focus so much on the fulfillment of prophecy in his narrative of Christ's life? Because it shows that Christ is the anointed one, the one chosen by God. Because who else could tell us the events of Jesus' life long before they even happened? What other god could tell us that Jesus would be born in Bethlehem 700 years before it actually happened? Only Jehovah could do that. And so the person he's talking of, the person that Jehovah is speaking about, must be the one that was chosen by Jehovah. God is fulfilling his purposes. He's accomplishing all his good pleasure. His plan is being fulfilled in the person of Christ. And that can be said of no other. That's why Matthew's going to focus so heavily on prophecy throughout his entire gospel narrative. And so understanding that, we come to the actual text that we want to look at this morning as we look at the obedience of Joseph. starting in verse 13, we're told, "Now when they had departed," and that "they" is the Magi, remember that they were told in a dream not to return to Herod. And so after they departed, probably the very next night, so if we try to order our thoughts in the timeline that's going on here, the Magi come from Jerusalem to Bethlehem, which is only a couple hour trip. It doesn't take them long to march that, and that's if they're walking. It only takes 2.5 to 3 hours. If they were riding camels or some other animal, which they most likely were, the trip is even much shorter than that. So they take a few hours, they come to Bethlehem, they worship Christ, they present their gifts, probably that night. God appears to them in another dream and says, don't go back to Herod. He's tricking you. Because the last thing the Magi have heard from Herod is, go find the child, and when you're done, come back and tell me. I want to worship him too. And so God is declaring even what's in the heart and mind of Herod here by revealing to the Magi, Herod is being deceptive. He's tricking you. He doesn't want to worship the child. He wants to destroy it. And so don't go back to him. Whatever you do, don't go tell Herod where this boy is. Now Herod already knows he's in Jerusalem. But God is buying time. And so he tells the Magi, don't go back to Jerusalem. So that evening, probably, they have their dream, and the next morning they depart to their own country by another way. Again, these events don't take long. Verse 13, when they had departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, rise, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him. So after they departed, after the Magi departed, Joseph has a dream. So then probably if the Magi are in Jerusalem on the first day and they come to Bethlehem, that night they have their dream and they leave the next morning heading their own way, then maybe that evening is when Joseph gets his dream. And again, well, I'm surmising and speculating, so if you want to disagree with me on this timeline, feel free. Probably that night, Joseph has his dream. Now remember again, Herod's purposes are he wants to destroy the child. He's waiting for the wise men to get back. How long is he going to wait before he realizes that the Magi are not returning to Jerusalem? It wouldn't be very long, because Jerusalem's only 5 miles away. And so he doesn't have to wait weeks, he doesn't have to wait months, he has to wait just a matter of hours before he realizes the Magi aren't coming back. They've gone another way, and he's going to realize that. So probably the very next night, Joseph receives his dream, and the dream is, rise up, take the child and his mother, and flee to Egypt, and remain there until I tell you. And we're going to see what Joseph is going to do here in just a moment. This revelation about what Herod is going to do, his intention towards the child, is Herod's deceitful plots finally revealed. Because remember, nobody else knew this. When he called the Magi together, he did it secretly. Not even the high priests or the scribes knew what Herod was intending when he sought out this child. But Herod is about to destroy him. The angel warns Joseph and says, you need to get out of here. Take the child, his mother, flee to Egypt, and remain there until I tell you. Egypt, why go to Egypt? You say, isn't there some other way that God could have protected his son? You say, absolutely. God could have sent, there's a song about this, he could have sent legions of angels to protect Jesus from Herod. Those soldiers could have all refused. God could have worked in Herod to say, you know what, never mind. There's a whole host of things that God could have done to protect his son. So why did he say go to Egypt? So that Jesus could fulfill this prophecy out of Hosea. So that God could call his son out of Egypt. So that prophecy would also point to Jesus as the person whom God had chosen. He is the Messiah. He's the one that God has appointed to be ruler over his people. All of these things point to who Jesus is. So why did he have to go to Egypt? Because it fulfills prophecy. Yes, God could have done something different. Yes, God could have protected Jesus in another way, but he did it this way because it points to Jesus being the Messiah. It's a sign to the person of his son. So this is the message to Joseph. Rise up, take the mother and his child and flee, and his child and her child, and flee to Egypt and remain there until I tell you. There's the instructions. Get up, take the mother and his, I keep wanting to say his, take the mother and her child go to Egypt and stay there. Four-part message. How many Simon Says's did we do this morning? I didn't even count. Okay, I know we were standing on one leg, we had one arm in the air, we were hopping up and down, and then we had other arms. So we had about four things. And they all did well, didn't they? They obeyed the commands they were given. What's Joseph going to do? This is crazy stuff. How many of us would be ready to obey at a moment's notice if God said, get up and leave? Get up and get out of here. Abandon everything. Now, how long has Joseph been in Bethlehem? At least a couple of years. Very possibly Joseph grew up in Bethlehem. He is of the house of David. He returned there for the census. He's been there for a couple of years, so this is not like he's still at the hotel. We know he's definitely not still in the stable. He's established his house. He's got it all set up. So how many of us, if God would call and say, get up and get out of here, would we be ready to go at a moment's notice? But Joseph is this kind of man. Because look at what he does. In his obedience, verse 14, he arose. Now, how many of you could wake yourself up out of a dead sleep? Here's how obedient Joseph is, and I think probably the Lord woke him up. But he arose, and we're going to see when he does this. He took the child and his mother, the next words, at night. Joseph doesn't even wait till morning. Now again, understand how imperative it is that Joseph gets going immediately, because Herod's soldiers are only a couple of miles away. It's not like it would have taken days for Herod's soldiers to reach Bethlehem. It would have taken hours. And so the message to Joseph, get up, get out of here right now, take the mother and her child and get to Egypt, had to be accomplished right away. Joseph couldn't be a man who sat there and said, well, I'm not really sure if this is God telling me to do this or not. I mean, is this, Lord, is this really the best idea? I'm not sure. I mean, Egypt, really, Lord? Egypt's awfully far away. Couldn't I flee somewhere else? And while Joseph would be debating about these things, there's the knock at the door, and there's the soldiers, and it's all over. But Joseph is the kind of man who is accustomed to obeying. He knows how to do what God tells him to do, and he knows how to do it exactly, and he knows how to do it immediately when he awoke. And the wording, both in the original text and here in the English, is almost exactly verbatim per the angel's commands. The angel says, rise, take the child and his mother. In verse 14, he arose and took the child and his mother by night and departed to Egypt. Joseph obeyed immediately and exactly as he was told. He gives us this great example of what obedience is supposed to be. Do what God tells you to do. Do it right when He tells you to do it. Do it without questioning Him. How many of you served in the military? We thank you for doing that, by the way. What branch did you serve in, Dan? What did you do for the first, right after you signed up, what's the first thing they send you to? What do you do in boot camp? Exact. What happens if you don't do exactly what they tell you? Okay. There's a very good reason for boot camp, and that is to teach people to do exactly what they're told, right when they're told it, without questioning orders. Because if you have all the soldiers questioning orders on the battlefield or in the ship, you have problems. If people aren't doing exactly what they're supposed to do. Now, we live in a society that is just absolutely consumed with self-determination. Say, I don't want anyone telling me what me to do. I want to be independent. I want to think for myself. I want to do what I want to do. Which, on the one hand, is a great thing when it's exercised towards liberty and serving the Lord the way that we're supposed to. If it's exercised towards our own selfish passions and indulgences, then it's a very, very bad thing. Because the Scriptures tell us there's no such thing as real freedom. You're either enslaved to God or you're enslaved to sin. There's no middle ground. Joseph is obviously a man who is absolutely sold into slavery to his God. Because when God gives him a dream and says, get up, leave your house, leave the job you've got established here, you've got a good reputation as a carpenter probably, get out of here and go to Egypt. Take the child and his mother and go. And Joseph wakes up and immediately takes them away. Because God has told him, here's what's coming next, Herod's terrible tantrum. You know how long it took me to come up with that alliteration there? Verse 16, then Herod, when he saw that he had been tricked by the wise men, became furious. This, again, as we've looked at the character of Herod in history, we understand this is not out of the ordinary for him. He had three of his own sons executed. He had his wife executed. He had many people in Jerusalem executed because he thought that they were trying to take away his authority as king. And here, so in order to try to stop the Messiah from coming to power, Herod is willing to take this terrible step. The wise men have tricked him. They didn't come back to him the way that he thought. Isn't it funny how someone that is deceitful hates being deceived? The thief can't stand being stolen from. It's his biggest fear. The liar hates to be lied to. Herod is absolutely enraged that the Magi did not return to him the way that he told them to, even though he was trying to trick them. He was exceedingly full of wrath. And how is he going to handle this? All right. He sent and he killed all the male children in Bethlehem and in all that region who were 2 years old or under, according to the time that he had ascertained from the wise men. So when he gathered the wise men together, he asked them when the star appeared, and they would have told him about 2 years ago. So that's where he's getting the number two. The star appeared when Jesus was born to the wise men, so he figures, all right, 2 years old and under, let's go take them all out, just in case. And he sends his soldiers the 5 miles from Jerusalem to Bethlehem to execute this horrible order. Now, we in our society, having been under the ministry of the Word of God for so long, have a hard time understanding how anybody could execute an order like that. What we just saw in Sunday school, Dan passed around pictures of ISIS executing children. Say, how do you put the gun to their head and pull the trigger? Much less in the days without guns, how do you put the sword and do what you were commanded to do? But they did. Now, we don't know how many children were in Bethlehem. Probably not many. It's not a big town. But the number doesn't matter all that much because of what Herod's going to do and the lengths he's willing to go to try and establish his own authority. But this also points to the person of Jesus because it's a fulfillment of what was spoken of by Jeremiah. A voice was heard in Ramah, weeping and lamentation. Rachel weeping for her children. She refused to be comforted because they are no more. Even this horrible event surrounding the life of Christ is an evidence that He is the chosen one of God. It fulfills prophecy. It points to Him. He's the Messiah. Well, Joseph, again, we're going to see his obedience, what kind of man he is. Back in verse 15, he was told to stay in Egypt until the death of Herod. Remain there until I tell you, back in verse 13. In verse 15, we see the fulfillment of that. He remained there until the death of Herod. Joseph leaves everything behind in Bethlehem at a moment's notice, goes to Egypt and stays there. It's a faraway country. Now, a couple of details in history. We know the census that took Joseph to Bethlehem happened in about 6 BC. So Joseph goes to Bethlehem in about 6 BC. Herod kills all the children under 2, which puts us to about 4 BC. So if Herod executes all these children in 4 BC, and that's when Jesus fled to Egypt, we know that Herod also died in 4 BC. So Joseph probably was in Egypt around a year. He supported his family, took care of his family. He did what he knew he was supposed to do until God came and gave him further instructions. We've mentioned this before. When you're looking for direction in life in some big area, you say, who am I going to marry? What college am I going to go to? What job am I going to have? What's my next step? When do I retire? Whatever it is you're facing, how do you know what God is leading to you to do there? Well, the answer is, until He tells you, you do what you know you're supposed to do. Do what is clear. Do what's obvious. Joseph did not suddenly and immediately learn how to obey God. He started doing it in the little things. So that when God said, You will not bear false witness. Joseph put that into practice in his life. It's a clear command. It's not hard to miss. Does God want me to lie? Ever? No. When God said, "You shall not worship any other gods before me," Joseph obeyed that clear command. When God said, "You shall not commit adultery," Joseph didn't. He obeyed the command. That's how he comes to be the sort of man that is ready to obey this out of the ordinary command at a moment's notice. You obey the things you know, and you let God direct in the things that you don't. And so Joseph stays in Egypt probably about a year until Herod dies. And when he hears in a dream in verse 20, an angel appears to him again and says, "Rise, take the child and his mother and go to the land of Israel. For those who sought the child's life are dead." Joseph remained in his exile until he was instructed to return. He gets the instruction. Herod's gone. He's dead. You can go back to Israel now. And again, Joseph's obedience to the command was immediate and exact. Because again, we have the command issued, "Rise, take the child and his mother and go to the land of Israel." And verse 21, "He arose, he took the child and his mother, and he went to the land of Israel." He does exactly what God commands him to do, and he does it immediately. And he starts heading back, because Joseph is a man of obedience. Now he runs into a little issue, and here again is where we say, if you're not sure what to do, if there's no clear command, do what you know you're supposed to do, practice yourself in obedience, and then you'll be ready when God does give you specifics. Because look at verse 22. He runs into an issue. "When he heard that Archelaus was reigning over Judea in the place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there." Well, there's a reason for that, and that is because as bad as Herod was, as horrible of a ruler as Herod was, his son Archelaus was worse. Herod ruled for 38 years with the support of the Roman government. The Roman government was corrupt. We think our government's corrupt today. We don't like paying taxes for the reason where the money goes today. Guess what the Roman government did? It was worse. And they supported Herod's rule, but even the Roman government couldn't put up with Archelaus. And after 9 years in power, they exiled him. And that's how bad. Of course, you can imagine being raised in Herod's household, what sort of an example Herod would have been to a young man. And so as Joseph's coming back to Egypt and he's getting news from the towns he stops in, "So Herod's gone? Yeah, Herod died. You hear what happened? Yeah, so who's ruling in his place?" "Oh, Archelaus." "Ew. Really? Is this the same Archelaus that he was raising? You know, his son Archelaus?" Yeah, that's him. He's ruling now." That's not good news. Archelaus is worse than his dad. So Joseph, he takes this pause because he is terrified to go back there. He knows that Archelaus is just as bad or worse than Herod. And he waits for specific instructions, and that comes at the end of verse 22, being warned in a dream. Now, we're not given the specific content of this dream except that he was warned. He didn't go back to Jerusalem. He didn't go back to Bethlehem and Judea. He went to the district of Galilee where he had been before the census was taken. And he went and lived in a city called Nazareth. And again, to fulfill prophecy, what was spoken by the prophets might be fulfilled. Joseph was a man accustomed to obedience. You learn obedience by learning in the obvious, normal, everyday things. God tells us don't lie. God tells us don't worship any other gods before Him. God tells us don't make idols. God tells us to honor our father and mother. God tells us don't murder. God tells us don't steal. God tells us don't commit adultery. He tells us don't covet. God gives us clear commands. Love your enemy. Pray for those that spitefully use you. Work with your own hands to provide your needs. Whatever the command is, God gives us those clear commands, and we need to be the kind of people like Joseph that exercise ourselves to do what we're told to do, to obey in the normal, the everyday, the ordinary, so that if God ever calls and says, "It's time to go, I want you to pack up and leave right now." Just like boot camp teaches you to obey your orders without question, without hesitation, then you'll be ready to say, "Yes, Lord, I'm on my way." We're celebrating communion this morning. We want to do so with that thought in our minds, because one of the commands given to us is to take communion in a worthy manner. In 1 Corinthians 11, as Paul's giving instructions about it, he says we should examine ourselves. Examine ourselves for what? To say, is there any area of my life in which I'm walking disobediently? Lord, are there any of the commands that you have given me in your word where I say, you know what, I'm really not doing that one, and I know it? Because if we come to this table and we take this bread and we drink this cup, knowing that we're walking in disobedience, that's what is taking it in an unworthy manner. And that's where the warning comes in, where he says that many of you have been sick and died. Joseph provides us a perfect example of what a man of God is supposed to be. A man that will obey quickly, immediately, exactly. Are we people like Joseph? And so as our men come forward, I'm going to have them come up now and we'll go ahead and get these things prepared. I want you to take a few moments to examine yourself and say, am I walking in obedience to the commands that God has given me? Is there any area of my life where I know, and the Lord's been working on me, but I've been resisting it, is there any area of my life that I need to repent of and return to faithful obedience to His Word? So we're just going to take a moment while it's quiet and have that time between you and the Lord before we partake of this meal together.